This is the Country Hour with Megan Hughes on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Thank you for your company on the Country Hour today. It's a Central Queensland takeover. I'm taking over for Callie Buchanan for the rest of this week, and I've got a few exciting things planned, including taking you to the Rockhampton Agricultural Show on Friday. It's show season, baby. It's well and truly kicked off this year. There's been a number of shows around, and a few of our rural reporters have headed along to their local show. And you know what? If I'm broadcasting from the beef capital, then of course I'm going to be talking about red meat. So first, I'm taking your steak order. Send them in 0487 993 222, or do you order something else when you go out? For me, it's an eye fillet, because if I'm splurging, I'm splurging, you know? It's cooked rare with a mushroom sauce and a side of chips and salad. Text me 0487 993 222. And the reason I'm asking is because Meat and Livestock Australia has been tracking the different ways chefs are serving meats like lamb, goat and beef, and what that actually means for our cattle producers. Brand content manager Mary Jane Morse tells Crispy and Yeomans, one significant trend is that chefs are using the whole carcass.
We're definitely seeing more cuts being used, so chefs are paying a lot more attention to using the whole carcass. It's not so much these days about just that 8% of the carcass and those kind of real hero steaks. We're seeing cuts like lamb neck, beef shin, tongue and intercostals, skirt steaks, all those things that have in the past that have been, you know, I guess considered secondary, are now, you know, they're regular menu items.
So Mary Jane, how are chefs cooking with these, with things like beef shin, lamb neck, tongue, heart, these meat products that previously haven't made as much of an appearance on the plate?
I think that, you know, chefs are so creative, and we're really seeing such a diversification of the cuisines and the cultures that are using our products. So some of that is definitely has been impacting this use. But I think where chefs become really creative and really smart is particularly with things like offals, with your tongues or veal, sweetbreads, whatever it is. Chefs are finding ways to create those dishes in familiar formats. So whether that is something that they crumb and they fry and they kind of serve it as a snack in a, you know, in a finger sandwich or whatever, they're kind of finding ways to make it feel familiar for a diner that may not have experienced that before. We're definitely also seeing more things like the emergence of beef and lamb charcuterie, which is really exciting, because that's definitely been a space in the past that has been very much dominated by pork. So we're seeing, you know, chefs creating things like lamb hams and beef bacon, mortadellas and more. So it's really exciting, given that that's, you know, primarily being a pork-focused space.
Mm. Are we seeing restaurants prioritise certain dishes or certain red meat dishes over others?
Absolutely, and that's definitely one of the key trends that we've talked about in the resource. Venues really zeroing in and focusing in on a signature dish. So whether that's, you know, in a pub, but they do this consistent, excellent Sunday roast, or, you know, they have the best burger in town or whatever it is. So there's definitely that focus on a single dish. But what has been emerging this year as well is single focus restaurants. So we're seeing restaurants that are popping up that are, you know, serving steak frites only, or for, you know, most Australians, that's steak and chips. So, you know, restaurants that are just focusing on that one thing. There's been steak frites restaurants, there's been birria restaurants popping up. So birria being a slow braised beef dish from Jalisco in Mexico. And diners are really responding to that, because it's this kind of laser focus on one thing. So, you know, it's going to be good. And it also means that they're pushing huge volumes of our protein, which is exciting as well.
I saw one of the statistics says that 60% of diners will return to a restaurant if there's just a single delicious standout item. That's enough to bring them back.
Exactly. And that's where chefs are smart as well. And I think that's where we've got some excellent opportunities with Australian beef and lamb, because our product is so diverse and so consistent, and these restaurants can have success with it and the diner can enjoy it every time.
Will that mean that chefs will often want to go to the same supplier for their meals if they're looking for something consistent?
Yeah, I think that there is definitely some chefs really have that close connection, and something that is coming across as well that we're seeing a lot more is diners are more educated and they're more aware, and they do want to know where their food's coming from, and they do want to know, you know, where the cuts come from, but how it's been raised and how it's been fed and all these kind of things. So there's definitely more connection between the chef and the producer, which I think is really important, and it's really coming to life through how they sell that story on the menu.
Yeah, I'm thinking, for example, carcasses and using different parts of an animal that people might not be used to eating. How do chefs actually sell that to the public?
Overall, there's more curiosity about what can be done and what can be eaten. And by the same token, consumers and diners, they care, as I was saying before, about the story and the sustainability. So I think chefs, venues, you know, they might be having special dry aged steak nights, or they might be having, you know, meat producer nights or whatever it is, and people are really engaging with that.
Mary Jane, do you see with some of these restaurant trends, do you expect them to continue long into the future, or do we know at this stage?
I think that, you know, they're not so much trends in the definition of the word as much, but more kind of, I guess, guiding principles on how we're cooking and how chefs and food service are responding to the changes in our economy, in our demographics, in our cultural makeup. So I think, you know, that it's going to be something that will live on, but as things change and as things adapt, we'll see how it goes. But I think a lot of them are definitely just key themes to think about, you know, respecting the whole carcass, understanding where things come from. Obviously, we've got many different cultures that are in Australia now, so ensuring that beef and lamb are understood and utilised in those areas as well. So I think, yeah, it's actually an exciting time for beef and lamb on menus across Australia.
Mary Jane Morse from Meat and Livestock Australia. Would you try offal, or is that something, you know, that you used to eat? It's amazing to hear that these sort of, I guess, the whole carcass is really being explored and used by chefs across Australia. Send me a text 0487 993 222. And if you're listening on the podcast, make sure you mention my name or Country Hour so I can see your wonderful messages as they come through. Now, you just heard from MLA about the big trends in restaurants, so it's time to hear from a chef and what they're doing. Frank Carenti is the head chef at a Queensland steakhouse, and he explains the cuts he likes to use and how he chooses the right supplier for his meats.
Rib fillet is my favourite cut, and just served simply on the grill. Yeah, beautiful. Cooked medium rare, rare to medium rare. But yeah, it's fantastic.
So what else do you usually accompany a beef dish?
With beef, I like to look at the flavour profiles of a cut itself. A fattier dish, a highly marbled dish, would need something to cut that fat. So I'd like to have something a little bit of acidic with it, and a lighter style beef with a less marbling. You can go tone it down a little bit, so more creamy style with it, or a smooth textures and smooth flavours with it. Mm. So, yeah, I like, look, a chimichurri goes really well with a well-marbled piece of meat or a rib fillet.
Yeah, so when you go about deciding what dishes you put on the menu at the Norman, what's kind of the things that are front of mind for you when it comes to some of those red meat meals?
Look, I say, look, 70% is tradition, because we've been around for the venue's been around 136 years as a steakhouse. We've been around 40 plus years. So our customers know and love us for what we do, which is steak. And so we need to keep the classics on there, the favourites on there, but then we try and give them a little bit of variety, obviously, depending on what's happening at the time. We try and move things around, and we try different things. So in a, winter, we may go a braised dish, so it's a little bit warming. In summer, we may do something lighter, like a carpaccio or a steak tartare, for instance. And they would usually come on as a special in addition to our traditional steakhouse menu.
Are those specials particularly popular, those different alternative meals that people might not see as often on the menu?
They generally are popular. We try and keep things changing, but they definitely are popular, and especially when people, we're a tradition, families go there maybe once a week, twice a month, three times a month, so they like to have a bit of variety as well, so they might try something different when they come into the hotel, and as opposed to when they normally come in, they might have their T-bone or the sirloin steak all the time, so they like to try something different.
Do you ever go really adventurous, like, brain or tongue or any of those parts of the carcass that are less popular?
Yeah, I definitely have. And I usually reserve those for our special event dinners. So we might have a wine dinner, perhaps, or a beer or a bourbon dinner. So they're the menus that I create something out there, I guess you'd say, for the everyday person. So I've created a tongue dish, I've braised it, corned it, and then braised it in ginger beer before, and served it as a croquette, as a starter, for instance. So I've done little things like that before. I've put oxtail, I've candied oxtail for a cheese platter before. So I've had beef as a dessert.
What?
I go out there a little bit. On the left side, and I've made we just had a function recently, a beef function, and I did a beef jus ice cream as a finisher. So basically a traditional beef jus, and then made it as an ice cream and served it in a waffle cone.
Amazing.
So you get some people that love it, and you get some people that turn the nose up at it, but overall, I believe it was a success, but that was... Yeah, so I do different things.
When you're thinking about your supplier and where you get your beef or your lamb or your goat from, what's kind of front of mind in choosing a supplier?
Look, supplier for me, I do two things. I menu engineer backwards. So I look at the size of, let's say we're talking about a steak cut here. I look at the size of steak cut first, and I'll see what I want to put on the plate. So if I'm looking for a 250 gram rib fillet, there's no way I'm going to use an animal that's 900 kilos live weight. So I'm looking for an animal that's going to probably, I'd say, dress at about 250. So you want a smaller primal cut, smaller rib fillet, because that way the piece of meat is going to cut well, and it's going to look enticing on the plate as well. It's going to have a little bit of thickness to it. So I, from the supplier's point of view, I look at the cattle they do, and then I work out of the right cattle for the right dish. And that's the way I work.
How often would you say you see significant fluctuations in your meat prices?
So we try and set our prices once a year or at the most twice a year. So we work directly with the producers and suppliers to ensure that we've got mostly an all-year-round costing, or we try and forecast the costs as best we can. So we try and set our prices as firm as possible. If not, try and do it quarterly or at least 6 monthly.
Right, so you don't change them. You usually don't change them too much. So for example, if the cost of steak, if you're trying to buy some meat to serve on the restaurant plate and it goes up by 50 cents, a dollar, $2, you're finding that you're absorbing that cost as opposed to putting up your prices.
Yeah, if there is, by chance, we don't change our brands on the menu. So our brands are set in stone. If by chance there is a price rise in meat, depending on the impact it may have, we absorb the price rise as much as possible, so it doesn't affect our customers. We offer a value for money service or a value for money meal, and that's our motto in what we provide. We don't provide a steak only on plate and then additional cost for your salad or chips or your carbs. we offer an all-in-one price for the meal. So where we can absorb the price, we definitely do. As I said, we don't change our, we change our menu print. We go to print maybe once a year, maximum twice a year. But yeah, we try and absorb as much as we can.
Frank Carenti, Queensland-based chef, speaking to Crispian Yeomans. Now, from restaurants to the supermarket, for more than a decade, food and beverage companies have been able to choose whether or not they put a health star rating on their packaging. But that all could be about to change. Fiona Broom has more.
Over the next few months, Australia's food safety regulator, FSANS, has the job of deciding whether all packaged foods should display a health star rating. Ratings are calculated using an algorithm that gives a product between half a star and five stars to help shoppers compare similar products. Ministers with food portfolios have said they want to see the system become compulsory after industry failed to meet voluntary targets. Associate Professor Alexandra Jones leads the Food Governance Program at the George Institute for Global Health, which has been monitoring the Health Star rating for 12 years. Dr. Jones says the system should be mandatory.
We think the system does work well overall, but the voluntary nature of it has really undermined its potential to function as a genuine public health tool. Well, what we've seen is that, probably unsurprisingly, in a voluntary system, companies that get a higher score have been more likely to put it on, but thousands of products that score half or one star are simply concealing that information from consumers.
Do you think the health star rating system then, if it were mandatory, would influence shopping behaviour of consumers?
We're really hopeful that it would. And there's quite a lot of consumer research that would support that. People can generally understand the system. More than 82% of people say that they'd like to see it mandated. So we think there is, you know, a groundswell of support. And right now, consumers simply can't use it because it's still missing from the majority of products. So if you're meant to use it to compare products, you just can't.
Some agricultural industries have been critical of the current system. Fruit growers in particular have said that soft drinks get a healthier rating than 100% juice products. As the system stands currently, is it fit for purpose? Is it giving consumers the health information that they need?
So how the algorithm works right now is basically it's an overall rating. So you lose points based on energy, saturated fat, salt and sugar content, and a product can gain some points back for its protein, its fiber and its fruit and veg content. The example you've pointed out sort of highlights how there's a conflict of interest between the food industry and the scores of any particular product. So they like the scoring system if their product does well, and they will critique the scoring system if their portfolio of products doesn't get a high rating. That's why it's really important that the Health Star algorithm is sort of independently governed, and if there is going to be an algorithm review, that this is done by independent experts with government input, but not with industry involvement.
The Australian Food and Grocery Council represents manufacturers and suppliers. Council Director of Health and Regulatory Affairs, Dr. Duncan Craig, says the industry is considering its position on whether the Health Star rating should be made mandatory, but he says changing packaging can be a big task for manufacturers.
The question is, I think we support the current Health Star rating system. What FSANS is proposing are some changes to that. So I think it's really important that before we go and say yes or no to, you know, do we support it being mandatory, that we really understand what it is that is being being implemented. What FSANS is proposing is some slight tweaks to the way the Health Star rating label is applied, both in terms of how it's presented on the front of pack, but also requiring likely changes to the back of pack, so the way the information is presented in the nutrition information panel or in the ingredients. So, you know, these sound small, but do have a lot of impacts to businesses, even, you know, for those that have already voluntarily applied the Health Star rating label.
About 37% or less than 40% of products are currently carrying the Health Star rating. Why would some companies be using it on labelling currently?
This is the nature of a voluntary system. You know, companies undertake their own assessments in terms of when they apply and how they apply labelling. I think, you know, regards on, you're right, the uptake, I think it was around 37 or 39%. It's not where the ministers wanted, and that's why the government is undertaking this process to look at mandating the system. But reasons for applying, you know, it can be down to just the timing and cost of label changes. label changes are really, really complicated. You know, we have businesses where, you know, they could have over 200 different product variants. Each of those require, you know, really detailed assessments. So that comes at really significant cost for industry.
Currently, it's the food and beverage companies who are responsible for the accuracy of Health Star ratings. Medical associations have told the ABC that an effective rating system must be led by government and free from industry interference. And Dr. Jones says the ratings algorithm should be expanded to also consider overlooked issues like food processing methods.
Nutrition science is always evolving, and in the last few years in particular, we've seen a lot more discussion about the degree of processing of a food and evidence that says that maybe there's something beyond just nutrients that's also bad about a product that we need to consider. But as it currently stands in Australian policy, we don't have recognition of that evidence on processing in our dietary guidelines, which makes it quite hard to get it into the Health Star rating. It's one of the reasons why we do have a new dietary guidelines coming out, and many of us in health groups have been asking that we do review the algorithm once those dietary guidelines have come out. And if there's something about processing, it should go into the algorithm.
However, Dr. Craig at the Food and Grocery Council argues that processed isn't always a bad thing.
Look, we think the current system is really grounded in robust scientific evidence. You know, as you mentioned, it includes consideration of those nutrients that we know have real impacts on health, such as you know, high levels of saturated fat, sugar and sodium. But I think this is the good thing about the Health Star rating system. It actually incorporates components that are positive for health, so fibre, protein, fruits, vegetables, nuts and legumes. In terms of level of processing, the Food and Grocery Council you know, does not believe the level of evidence is there to really incorporate that into a system like this. Incorporating level of processing would negatively impact many nutritious products, things like whole grain bread or various yogurts. You know, these are foods that are recommended in dietary guidelines as core foods.
Dr. Jones acknowledges the current Health Star rating algorithm isn't perfect, but says that making it mandatory will ultimately boost public health.
The opportunity that we see now, the political window of opportunity, is to mandate, and that is a critical window, I think, for us to make use of. We are asking in parallel for there to be a commitment to reviewing the algorithm, but we don't want to slow down the process of mandating or miss that window by discussing too much the algorithm right now.
The current system, as you said, has been around for more than a decade. Would it be something that would be easy to update, or has it proven to be difficult to do so?
It's been challenging to update the voluntary system in part because it relies on everybody to play nice, like I said. So it's sort of any change we've made to date, we've still relied on industry to buy into the system. And so we haven't been able to do some of the stronger, I think, evidence-based updates, so being stronger on sugar and salt, for example. That's why we're sort of saying that in mandating, you make it very clear that this is a government-led public health tool. It is no longer to be used as just a marketing tool by the food industry, and we are going to get serious on making this a better and more transparent tool for consumers.
Associate Professor Alexandra Jones from the George Institute for Global Health, ending that report from Fiona Broom. It is 28 minutes past 12. Up next, rain is wreaking havoc on Tully's Cane Crush.
ABC Radio is part of your community, telling local stories that matter to you. So for local news, sport, and to find out what's happening in your community, stay tuned right here on your radio and on ABC Listen.
On your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
The harvesters have pulled up in Tully just 2 weeks after the crush started, and it's all to do with the rain. Alf Nusifora farms cane in the region, and he says in the last day, different areas have had different rainfall totals, but all look upwards of 20 millimetres.
In the Murray where I farm, we've probably had about 24 to 25 mil. Some of the other regions have had more. I was talking to a mate yesterday, and he sort of said that he had upwards of 40 mil in Urimo, but that mightn't be all of Urimo. That might be different parts of Urimo. And I did hear figures above 30 in Tully, but that's all I can tell you on the rainfall side. it has been enough to actually pull up the harvest in Tully.
So harvest has come to a halt then?
Harvesters have come to a halt in Tully. We've had a very good start, but unfortunately the rain had interfered the last 36 hours and didn't have our good start come to an end.
When will the crushing restart?
Well, I think the mill has pulled up for maintenance while the weather's like this, and they will do their various repairs and all that need doing, and they'll then ask when the last harvest is, when they're fit to go. If the weather comes good, they'll start again. And I don't really know if the weather can be good in the morning when you wake up and then it starts raining, so I think they'll want at least 24 hours sun before they get going again in certain regions.
When you said it's been a good start for the crushing in Tully, can you tell me a bit more about that? How good?
The weather's been good, nice and dry. I think we've crushed about upwards of 180,000 tonne, and the CCS has been at times daily above 13, which has been a long time since I've seen that, maybe 10 years ago or a little bit less. But it's been good. I hope it stays like that after this rain goes and we can have a good mill average CCS when we finish the season. It will make a difference to our pocket at the end of the year when it comes Christmas time.
Have you started harvesting yet, Alf?
No, I'm last. When you're in a harvesting group, you go in a rotation, and then each farmer does 5 rounds, but then depending on the amount of farmers in your group, you go in consecutive order. 1 year you might be first, and the next year I go to last. The next year, some people do it a different way. Yeah, I'm last this year, so I probably won't get the harvester for another 2 weeks yet.
Will this rain delay when you can start harvesting then?
I probably might delay it a few days, but I think that if the weather comes good, a few harvesters actually harvest cane in the Murray will migrate to the Murray and get the mill started, so we're starting to move with the crushing again.
How are things looking this morning at your place? Is it still raining?
No, it's not raining at the moment. Actually, when I got out of bed there earlier, the stars were out. It was actually looking good. But they were out this time yesterday morning, and then it rained within another hour. So we'll just see what happens.
That was Tully Region cane farmer Alf Nusifora speaking with Sophie Johnson. You'll hear all about the rain from the Weather Bureau up next, and then some great news for beekeepers and apiarists. There's been a breakthrough in the fight against varroa.
Who will win the AI race? Has gambling become our national sport?
Questions. They've never been more important. So the one thing we'll never question is our duty to keep asking. ABC News, keep asking.
On your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app, this is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
It's time to check in on the weather, and Shane Kennedy joins me now from the Bureau of Meteorology. Good afternoon, Shane.
Good afternoon, Megan.
So, as you heard in Tully, there's been a bit of rain about, causing havoc with the crush, the cane crush up there. But what about around the rest of the state as well? Is this rain going to continue?
I expect we've got a couple of areas of focus that will continue to see some rain the next couple of days. So the first one, as we've heard, is mainly just in eastern districts. So we saw some decent falls just inland in Mackay on the Clark Range, with a few places picking up 30 to 50 millimetres there. And also saw just under 30 millimetres around Yeppoon in the 24 hours to 9 a.m. And also ongoing rainfall around the Gold Coast hinterland. And that's still continuing today, mostly been a little bit lighter, but still some showers pushing in across the North Tropical Coast and a bit more steady in southeast. And then so the second area of focus, that's more in the southwest and the southern interior of the state, where we do have a trough system that's been creating a fairly broad area of showers as well as some isolated thunderstorms as well. So it's been located at the moment south of Longreach and extending down, mostly west of St George at the moment, but again did see some moderate rainfall there in the past 24 hours, so particularly around Quilby that had its wettest June day in about 10 years there.
Yeah, wow. And how much sort of rainfall is, when we're talking about totals in this lot of rainfall?
So in terms of the inland rainfall, so expect we'll continue to see mostly falls in that 10 to 30 millimetre range, but just as we've seen over the past 24 hours, expect we'll continue to see some isolated falls in that 30 to 50 millimetres today. So it'll mostly be west of Roma today. They should extend and reach St George later in the day. And then tomorrow that will shift a little bit further east, but still extending up to around Longreach. And then east of Charleville, so mostly through the Roma area and into the Darling Downs and Granite Belt District. And similar rainfalls once again there, Megan, so typically 10 to 30 millimetres, but some isolated 30 to 50 millimetres, particularly in those slow-moving thunderstorms. And for the east coast, looking pretty similar. It's mostly in that 5 to 15 millimetre range, but just as we've seen over the past day, still could potentially see some 20 to 40 millimetres or so in a few places here and there.
Mm. And, you know, how long is it going to hang around for? Are we expecting it to continue into next week?
So moving through the peak at the moment is the expectation. So that trough system will move a little further east tomorrow, but then really should weaken off on Thursday night. And so not much of it will be left by the time it makes it to the coast. Though we may see a few isolated thunderstorms south of around Bundaberg on that Friday, so there is that potential to see a little bit more rainfall in a few pockets just during that Friday. But otherwise, with that system really weakening off, and the moisture also seems to decrease quite a bit starting on the Friday and continuing over the weekend. So showers really contracting to the east coast, but likely persisting for several days, as we'll still be sitting under this ridge of high pressure. That'll be driving some onshore winds, so at least getting some coastal showers will persist for several days, probably at least as far as mid-next week, but I'm not expecting it to be quite as significant as the rainfall today and tomorrow.
Mm. So, looking forward, what else is sort of in the watch points?
In terms of rainfall, could still see at least some moderate, still see some rainfall up around that 5 to 15 millimetre range persisting over the North Tropical Coast, but it should ease off a bit more, as mentioned, on the weekend. And looking further ahead, second half of next week, we might see another trough system approach. So mostly be impacting New South Wales, but that'll be a watch point. Possibly late Wednesday, we might see it starting to creep into the southwest of the state, but probably more Thursday and Friday next week will be another watch point for southern Queensland for some more rainfall. And in terms of the temperatures, so we still have some unusually warm temperatures, mostly focused through western Queensland, with both those afternoon and overnight temperatures have been typically in that 2 to 6 degrees above average. That's expected to continue for several days. We still have these onshore winds along the east coast, and that's pushing some of that warmer, more moisture-filled air well inland, and so that's really keeping those temperatures up and really not expecting too much change in the next several days there, Megan.
Yeah, so no frosts warnings or anything like that. By the sounds of it, it's going to stay quite mild.
That's right, yeah. Certainly, after we had a bit of a cold start to winter, it's back right off now, and you're typically average, even nudging well above average in some parts. So not expecting any frost, though. Could potentially see some fog in the wake of these showers over the next couple of mornings, so particularly in the southern interior.
Mm. Now, Shane, in terms of the coastal forecast, anything in the way of winds and swell?
So we do have some strong wind warnings just for the far northeastern waters starting tomorrow, so Cooktown and Peninsula waters. So that breaks what I was saying yesterday when I thought we'd get away with no strong wind warnings for the next few days, but that looks to be proven false alas. So nudge just into that strong wind warning territory in those enhanced southeasterlies. Later this week, so Thursday and Friday, and possibly into the weekend as well. And elsewhere, still fairly fresh, just under the influence of that large high-pressure system near New Zealand, so mostly in that east to south-easterly 15 to 20-knot range, but getting a bit fresher in those far northeastern waters. And fairly similar in the Gulf, and probably the only real path that escapes that are the paths of the southeastern waters, so south of the Capricorn waters, where we do have some periods more in that 10 to 15-knot range. And in terms of the swells, again, with that fairly stable setup out near New Zealand, that is driving some easterly swell across the southeastern waters, and that'll persist for several days to come. So it's thankfully staying a little bit lower in terms of the heights. I'm not expecting any warnings out of that, but be pretty sustained and fairly at least lasting until late next week.
Shane, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Megan. Have a good afternoon.
You too. Shane Kennedy, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology.
A tray of cocktails floated at us through the twilight. Who was this Gatsby fella?
A jazz-soaked reimagining of the Great Gatsby.
That's the best thing a girl can be in this world. A beautiful little fool.
Search for Gatsby in Harlem on ABC Listen.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Attention, everyone.
There's been potential advancement made on the fight against varroa. The risk of the mite varroa destructor to the agricultural industry is significant, but a new biopesticide developed in New Zealand can make varroa destructor mite infertile, and it's been described as a holy grail by its lead researcher. And could it be used in Australia? Well, reporter Anita Ward spoke with Victoria University of Wellington entomologist Professor Phil Lester and PhD student Johanna Merck about their research. Professor Lester explains how this biopesticide works.
It's using what we call a biopesticide, that's highly specific, highly targeted towards varroa, and in this case stops varroa from reproducing. So the approach uses something called gene silencing, and what we do is we synthesize a strand of RNA, double-stranded RNA, that is introduced into the hives by the bees. We have a pouch that contains the sugar water plus the double-stranded RNA. That double-stranded RNA is taken up by the bees and distributed around the hive, and it's there where it comes into contact with the varroa. The varroa then seem to absorb it. And what it does effectively is it inhibits gene pathways associated primarily with reproduction. And so the mites are unable to produce viable eggs.
And do we know if it's safe for honeybees? You said you've been, you know, looking at honeybee hives in particular.
So what I looked at in my experiment is this treatment safe for honeybees? Does it have any influence on their lifespan or on their foraging behavior? So what we did is we tagged individual bees just when they were born with like tiny little RFID chips. These chips record whenever the bees leave the hive or come back into their hive. So we can not only record how long the bees live for, but also when are they out foraging, how much do they forage. And then we treated these hives with the tagged bees with different treatments. We had a control that wasn't treated against varroa. And then we also used this new biopesticide to treat against varroa. And we found that the bees actually live longer when they're treated with this biopesticide, and also that they are more active foragers. So they do more foraging trips. They are a little bit quicker to return to the hive and just generally seem to be doing better than bees that are not treated. So that indicates that it's actually safe for the bees and might even have beneficial effects potentially in your hive.
From a very basic layman's sort of terms, can either of you describe, you know, what a biopesticide actually is and how it could be applied to, say, the varroa or the bees, or how that actually works?
So biopesticides are often based around natural chemicals that are utilised in the environment. So sometimes people will get a natural pyrethroid, for example, can be derived from a plant itself or synthetically made. So a pyrethroid that's derived from a plant could be considered a biopesticide. This biopesticide's based on a product, the double-stranded RNA or RNA that every cell and every organism has. That RNA that is utilized, it's a system that's only we've only known about for the last 25 years that this can have a major effect on organisms and controlling gene regulation. So we're beginning now to exploit that for pest control purposes. I suspect that this way of controlling pests will be utilised for a wide range of pests, not just varroa mites, but it has been commercially deployed now by Greenlight Biosciences, the company associated with this, for Colorado potato beetle. So a major pest there is sprayable. So there's an awful lot of ways you can spray it. In this case, we are giving it to the bees and mites in a sugar water sort of solution that's spread around the hive. But there's a number of different ways that it could be applied to hives and to pest populations.
And in terms of, you know, the impact that a biopesticide could have on areas like the Riverland, like South Australia, which is impacted by varroa mite, what sort of impact do you see it having?
The benefit of this biopesticide is it's kind of almost the holy grail of pesticide treatments, right? So what you really want with a biopesticide or any pesticide is to be able to specifically target a pest, to have no non-target effects, you know, outside of that pest, for it to break down, for it to not be harmful to people. And this really seems to focus a lot on that to achieve lots of those goals. You guys in Varroa and in Australia at the moment have problems with Varroa in terms of you've got populations that are resistant to the key chemicals that are utilised for Varroa control, pyrethroids and ametraz. So those are the key synthetic chemicals that are utilised for Varroa control the world around. I think it's almost more of a important for Australia to adopt this sort of techniques and an approach than it is for New Zealand, where we don't have the same resistance issues in Varroa.
So after a decade of research, Phil, and a lot of work that's gone into this, what are the next steps to get it out to the market and make this really applied in industry?
So there's Greenlight Biosciences, the company that have produced this. They now have to go through the registration process, and they are doing that many countries around the world, including looking at the Australian market. And Australian beekeepers, I would talk to Greenlight and encourage them to get involved and develop this for your market as well. So it's really up to them in terms of getting that product into Australia, registering it and having it utilised over there.
That was Victoria University of Wellington entomologist Professor Phil Lester and PhD student Johanna Merck speaking with Anita Ward. It is 14 minutes to one. Carol's texted in about the earlier story on the rain in Tully impacting the crush 2 weeks after it started. She said, "Hi, Megan. Well, it's the way here. If we want rain, all we have to do is wait till the sugar mill starts, then it rains. The weather gods like grumpy cane growers." Thank you so much for your text in, Carol. And if you want to join the conversation on the Country Hour today, you can send me a message on 0487 993 222.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
To some breaking news now, Mackay Sugar is currently responding to a cybersecurity incident affecting operations. Cane farmers in Farley received a phone call about 4 this morning from Mackay Sugar to halt cane harvesting operations, with an email sent to growers and contractors around 7 a.m. Now, the ABC has seen a copy of the email. It says the company's focus is on the safety of their people, protecting operational systems and maintaining business continuity. They say they have engaged specialist cybersecurity experts and are working closely with relevant authorities to investigate and restore systems safely. And they said that there will be some disruption while recovery activities continue. However, their teams are working hard to minimise impacts on operations and on stakeholders. And no time frames have yet been given. Now, this incident comes less than a week after Mackay Sugar's Farley Mill started crushing cane for the 2026 harvest. Amy Mitchell spoke with local cane farmer Andre Camarelli, who says if there was one positive, it was that the incident happened before all 3 of Mackay Sugar Mills were up and going, with Racecourse Mill kicking off production yesterday and Marion Mill due to start on Monday.
If there is an upside, at least we got the showery rain, it'll pull us up for a couple of days while these showers pass through and sun comes out and mill gets up and going, we'll be right.
That was local cane farmer Andre Camarelli speaking there. Now, Liam O'Connell attended a press conference at Cane Growers Mackay, where Chairman Joseph Borg says 2/3 of the growing district will be affected.
All I was told was an IT breakdown. What such things as locos and trains on the tracks, they have fallback measures to get them back to the factories, and they are doing that. They have gone back to the old style, which is their safeguards, and then they're slowly working and getting all the cane and all the bins and logos back to where they need to be, to their depots. So that's happening as we speak, and they are working at all their sites and all their different things to get everything back online as quickly as possible.
Is it a big blow, barely a week in, that something like this has happened to stop?
Put it this way, it's a cyber attack, as you know, can happen at any time. It has happened in the past, if that's what it is. Mm. And I guess it's just something that the world has to deal with. It's a week in. It might have been a month in. It could have been at the end of the crush. And I don't think that these sort of things have timing to suit.
That was Kangaroos Mackay Chairman Joseph Borg speaking at a press conference in Mackay this morning. Now, Mackay Sugar has also been contacted for comment.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
Now, I'll take you from the Kangaroos in Mackay dealing with a cyber security outbreak, and I'm taking you to Australia's largest cattle selling centre, Roma. So it's getting a facelift and will look a little bit different under a multi-million dollar upgrade plan. Starting with three new road train ramps, the plan will be rolled out over 10 years. And Maranoa Council Mayor Wendy Taylor tells Bella Monroe what the upgrades will involve.
A lot of money, actually, which is great. The sale yards are, it is a master plan that we have actually met with the agents last Thursday with the plan. They hadn't seen it before, and we actually want to get it right. So they've had some input, so we'll take that back and rejig a few things. But basically, it's just all about trying to keep the sale yards safe, workable, you know, just future planning, really. Yeah.
And how long has it been in the works for?
I think the manager brought it to council last year, and we didn't have the money. Most of everything that gets done at the sale yards comes from sale yards, so they're a commercial identity in their own right. So basically, this will come out of the reserves of the sale yards, and it's a 10-year plan. Like, it's not a 2-day plan. We're starting off with doing three double deck road train ramps, and we're also doing some asphalt works on the existing truck hard stand. So that's probably $5 million to start with. So it all takes time and money, but, you know, our aim is just to get it right. If it has to go back to the drawing board 10 times, that's what'll happen.
And do you know how much is going into it in total?
No. We're only going piece by piece at the moment. And we do have a fair bit of land out there. So, like, it might not all be sale yards, you know. We might try and extend it to some other, you know, like a sale yards precinct, I guess. So whatever that looks like in the future, I'm not 100% sure. And, you know, you've got to also think about different options, you know, like we have to think about shade now, but is it shade and trees, or is it just, you know, shade cloth and all the things for animal welfare, as well as the buyers and the sellers as well.
Why are you starting this project now, and do you think the sale yards have been in need of improvements or upgrades for a while?
I would say that most things always need upgrading and improving as you go on. And I guess because we think we are the best sale yards in Australia, we just want to keep that reputation, and we're just working really hard to make it workable for everybody that comes into the yards.
As part of the first initial stages, you're calling for community and stakeholder feedback. What have some of the feedback been so far?
Well, so far we've only put it to the agents, which, as I said, was last Thursday, and they were very positive about, I'm going to say, 85% of it. They did have some really good ideas. I mean, they're the ones working the yards, to be honest. They, you know, the flow of the cattle and stuff like that. So we'll take that back, and we'll come back again and just see what they think of the next mock-up.
And you mentioned that this is a pretty long-term plan, you know, probably the next 10 years or so. Mm-hmm. What would you hope the end goal of this project to be with the sale yards?
I'm going to say probably just keep the reputation that we have, that these are the best sale yards in the country. We work hard with that. Council is very proud of that. The Maranoa is very proud of that. So, and, you know, with any budgeting, you know, you need a 10-year forecast just to make sure that we're, you know, improving all the time. The performance, the users, everybody, you know, on site is happy with what we have.
Wendy, was there anything else that you wanted to share about the plan?
No, not about the plan, but could I just do a little pitch for Lifelight? They have what they call in the cash cow for June. So they're asking people to donate either a beast or money or a percentage of their sales to go to Lifelight. So that'll be happening all through June, and council then waivers all the fees that go with that.
I'm hoping they have a good month.
And would you be able to talk to me a little bit more about the impact that will have on LifeLight and the kind of work that they do?
Well, it is all about the community, and they are all about the community. You know, they're a critical part of the Maranoa, especially with oil and gas and that, like, they just, their emergency care across Queensland, but really rural, regional and outback communities couldn't survive without them. And so, you know, we do count on it. I had one of my daughters get flown out a few years back. So we really do count on them, and we try to support them in any way possible.
Maranoa Council Mayor Wendy Taylor speaking to Bella Monroe. And it's time to check in on the markets. And first up is the Dalby cattle sale, where Trevor Hess has the details.
The large lift in prices the previous sale resulted in the supply of stock increasing by 3,355 head to 8,029 at Dalby today. Cows dominated the selling pens with 2,036 head penned. The larger numbers had no effect on prices, with most descriptions sold to a dearer trend on top of the improvements experienced the previous week. Yearling steers to feed gained 8 and considerably more in places. Yearling heifers to feed lifted in price by 30 to 40. Grown steers and bullocks also averaged a few cents dearer. Medium weight plain conditioned cows were firm, while the heavyweights gained 7 to 20. Heavyweight yearling steers to feed averaged 528 and 8 to 580. Medium weight yearling heifers to feed averaged 488 and sold to 538. The heavyweights also sold to 538 to average 481. A small selection of bullocks made to 468. Medium weight 2-score cows averaged 347, while heavyweight 3-score cows averaged 390. And the best of the cows made to 438 to average 417. Heavyweight bulls were noticeably dearer and made to 432. This has been Trevor Hess from MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Over to the Charters Towers Selling Centre with Mick Kingham.
Good afternoon. The continued strong supply of cattle saw numbers increased by 736 on last week to 3,173 head in a prime-only sale. Quality was mixed, comprising of some very good heavy bullocks, mixed pens of grown heifers and 215 cows, mostly in prime condition. The regular panel buyers were present and operated selectively, with only one southern operator present. Cattle were drawn from Norman and Julia Creek, many northern Gulf areas and the local supply area. At the time of this interim report, most categories eased, with HGP cattle attracting minimal demand and were subsequently discounted. Most categories slipped 3 to 18 cents. Only well-finished heavyweights were firmed to 2 cents higher. Yearling steers above 400 kilos to feed sold from 366 to 392. Trade heifers made 370. Grown steers above 400 kilos to trade sold from 326 to 386 to average 373. Heavy grown steers above 500 kilos reached 406 to average 391. An increased offering of prime grown heifers of mixed quality and weight sold from 270 to 396, best types average 381. Heavy bullocks to export slaughter sold from 382 to 404, a very good line of young bullocks average 393. An increased supply of medium weight 3-score cows made from 310 to 368, average 343. A good sample of prime heavyweight 3 and 4-score cows sold from 310 to 380. An exceptional pen of heavyweight 4-scores topped at 382. Heavy bulls processes made to 376. This is Mick Kingham from Charles Towers and National Livestock Reporting Service.
And Richard Thompson has the numbers from Gracemere.
CQLX Gracemere vendors offered an increased yarding of 2,887 head today, 1,977 up on last sale. As usual, a mixed quality yarding and planing condition in some places, with some well-bred, well-presented cows, heifers and steers in most divisions, along with plain quality and light condition coastal cattle in other places. The best presented pens of bullocks and heavy cows have improved again on their last week's rates. Grown steers and bullocks to processors averaged 400 cents to 435 cents a kilo, depending on condition. Whilst grown heifers to the trade reached 443 and averaged 375 to 402 cents. Plain 2-score cows mostly sold to 365, averaging from 339 for the best. Whilst best presented 4-score cows sold to 407, averaged 14 cents a kilo better than last week at 390. Heavy bulls averaged 386. Also up 20 cents a kilo on last week's sale. This has been Richard Thompson for the National Livestock Reporting Service of the MLA from Gracemere.
And that's all we have time for on the Country Hour today. Thank you so much for your company. My name is Megan Hughes. News is up next. It's 1 o'clock.